Memo from Hurricane Ike.
Nature's waiting.
Winds are singing in South Texas as Ike approaches, but are powerful tropical storms actually being driven by climate change? Maybe one way of looking at this is the people of Houston are canaries in a global warming coal mine. Nothing's wrong. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. It's Friday, September 12th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away for one more day, and then she's back next week, and we're excited about that. Hurricane Ike is growing. Lehman Brothers is shrinking. Zimbabwe is talking, and when all else fails to soothe, there's music. Those stories and more today. But first, some headlines. The National Weather Service isn't messing around. The agency says that some Texas residents face certain death if they don't evacuate ahead of Hurricane Ike. Texas Governor Rick Perry is emphasizing the dire predictions.
Without an evacuation, that model shows 1.5 million people dead. Yeah, I did not misspeak.
The storm is barreling toward Texas and getting stronger along the way. It could produce a wall of water 20 feet high and 50-foot waves. Warnings are in effect for 400 miles of the U.S. coast this morning. Vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin's first interview since she became John McCain's running mate aired last night. Palin told ABC's Charles Gibson that she's got what it takes to be in the White House and that she didn't hesitate for a second when McCain asked her to join the ticket.
You can't blink. You have to be wired in a way of being so committed to the mission that we're on, reform of this country and victory in the war.
Gibson met with Palin in her home state of Alaska. An historic day in Zimbabwe. Last night, President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai finally reached a power-sharing agreement. It's taken almost 2 months of tough talks. Good morning, Femi Oke. How am I doing here?
Hello there, John. Good job so far. We're also seeing some developments coming out of South America, where tensions are rising between the U.S. and Bolivia and Venezuela. First, Bolivia booted out its U.S. ambassador over accusations he was encouraging anti-government protests. Washington returned the favor. Now Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has jumped into the fray. He's just kicked the U.S. ambassador out of his country. Investment giant Lehman Brothers has thrown in the towel and is looking for a buyer. The fourth largest investment bank in the U.S. tried to convince shareholders it could stay afloat, but put itself up for sale. Share prices were down to just 4.25 by the time the markets closed.
Oil prices rose to about $100.01 a barrel in Asian trading over fears of Hurricane Ike. The Dow and the S&P gained yesterday, and they're poised to open. The S&P will open at 1249. So today, for Friday, when all else fails, you believe this, right? There's music, correct?
Yeah.
What's your mood-changing music out there? What do you listen to when times are rough? What song can you count on? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And we're also talking about Sarah Palin's interview with Charles Gibson. What did you take away from the interview, and what does she still need to be asked? Send us your questions at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We got to reform government. We got to fix the economy. We got to create jobs. But right now, we have to restore trust and confidence in government.
The fact is that we have to have government. When a hurricane strikes, as it did with Katrina. We have to have a FEMA that works.
On January 20th, when John McCain and I are sworn in, if we are so privileged to be elected to serve this country, we'll be ready. I'm ready.
Well, as you can hear last night, three out of four of the members of the Democratic and Republican presidential tickets were in the spotlight, and all three delivered sharply different insights into the nature of their campaign, their strategy for the future, and what's important to them. John McCain, Barack Obama, and Sarah Palin all had primetime appearances in question and answer sessions. Barack Obama and John McCain were at Columbia University at a very serious sort of service forum at the university. It was a day, of course, memorial for 9/11. The discourse and tone of the campaign was far, far removed from the lipstick and pig discussions that dominated the weekend. At the Columbia University event is Andrea Bernstein, our Takeaway political director. You were there last night. You also saw the Palin interview on ABC, which was a very different sort of story. First of all, set the scene. What was going on at Columbia?
Well, the forum was supposed to be about national service, a nonpartisan event, and Barack Obama and John McCain were in front of a hall, and there were a lot of reporters in another building across the quad from them. Turned out to be a little more interesting than you might expect an event where people promise no partisanship.
Right. It was billed pretty wonky, but it actually turned out to be more interesting.
I think especially for John McCain, he had sort of a heavy lift because he had to criticize President Bush without overtly criticizing President Bush and yet distance himself. He had to criticize government and yet promote the idea of government service. And he had to defend Sarah Palin while at the same time sort of backing off some of the harsher attacks of the week. And one of the things that was interesting about the event is the premise of the event was that September 11th created a sense of higher purpose in Americans. And the organizers wanted to capture that higher purpose and put everybody to work. So they asked people, you know, what happened after 9/11. And one of the particularly revealing McCain answers was this one.
And I think that if we had asked for a concrete plan of action, both on the part of federal, state, and local governments, as well as by the Congress of the United States, as well as, frankly, talking directly to the American people, and the need for us all to serve this nation, I think perhaps we...
And he never finishes the sentence, because perhaps we would have had a different outcome if President Bush hadn't been the president.
But he's talking about the sort of spirit of unity after 9/11 that would be mobilizable as some kind of national service sort of momentum, and it never really happened.
Right. He was talking about that. And another interesting row to hoe for him was that the idea of this negative campaign came up, and he was sort of asked repeatedly, well, if you have a negative campaign, aren't you dampening interest in government? Mm-hmm. Aren't you doing the very thing that you argue against, which is turning people off government? And he was very specifically asked about the attack that came up at the convention by Sarah Palin and Rudy Giuliani on community organizers.
Well, I mean, they poked fun of community organizers, and Barack Obama is a community organizer.
Right. Or was. Right. I mean, it's one of his credentials. So there was John McCain not wanting to sort of let his vice presidential candidate twist in the wind, but also not wanting to say something bad about community service at a community service event.
Governor Palin was responding to the criticism of her inexperience and her job as a mayor in a small town. That's what she was responding to. Of course I respect community organizers. Of course I respect people who serve their community. And Senator Obama's record there is outstanding.
That's interesting because, you know, I mean, John McCain has a lot of challenges, hoeing this row. But I'm wondering, you know, he's had the best lines of the week, both he and Palin have. I mean, did he defend his campaign at all?
Well, he sort of didn't when asked about the negative campaign.
Really?
He ducked that question. Barack Obama had a much easier time and sort of a warmer audience. I mean, he is a Columbia grad. He got
New York.
You know, hoots and hollers. And but perhaps the line of the night did go to Barack Obama when he was talking about he would go to Washington. He would sort of revive, implied the Kennedy era, the best and the brightest.
What we also want to do is to remind young people that if it weren't for government, then we wouldn't have a Civil Rights Act. If it weren't for government, we would not have the interstate highway system. If it weren't for government, we would not have some of our parks and natural wilderness areas that are so precious to America. And so part of my job, I think, as president, is to make government cool again.
Perhaps avoiding the best and brightest, which led us to Vietnam. Your words, not his. Talk a bit about Sarah Palin. I mean, Charlie Gibson took some great pains to try to reveal a little more about Sarah Palin. How do you think he did, and what do you think we know today that we didn't know yesterday?
Well, there was clearly pressure on him as well as her.
Right.
She obviously was very well prepared for this interview, except on the question of the Bush Doctrine and whether she believed in sort of pre-intervention as Bush does. She says she's ready. I wouldn't expect her to say otherwise. Barack Obama is also ready. He's got a big ad ready to go just off the transom where he's attacking John McCain on his experience.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Watching that interview last night, both of them were under so much pressure, as you said. I left feeling like maybe this isn't the best way to learn about a candidate, and it's maybe not the best form for journalism. Andrea Bernstein, thanks for being
with us.
Thank you. Very interesting campaign developments today. Is it a pause, a high-minded pause? Do we go back to slash and burn? We'll certainly know later on in the week. But there's a big story brewing on Wall Street, and joining us now is Ben White, a financial correspondent for The New York Times. Investment bank Lehman Brothers is continuing its struggle to stay alive today, but it's shifted its focus from trying to find a buyer for its assets to trying to find a buyer for the whole kit and caboodle. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Bring us up to date. What's going on in the advance before the markets open this morning on Wall Street?
Dick Fuld, the CEO of Lehman Brothers, I think has finally kind of given up the fight to stay independent and realized he needs to find a white knight, needs to find a buyer. So they've opened up the books. They've invited people to come in and take a look and see if they can get comfortable with some of Lehman's holdings and buy the whole thing outright. And the two we believe are in the lead right now are Bank of America and Barclays. And the question, of course, is what role the government will play in any sale.
Well, late yesterday, it appeared as though the government was signaling that it was not going to play any role at all, and that that was having a fairly draconian effect on Lehman Brothers' stock. Is there still a chance that the government might do something similar to what bailed out Bear Stearns?
There's a chance. I think they certainly don't want to do it if they don't have to. And I think their role right now has been to kind of knock heads together and make it clear to Lehman that they'd like to see it sold and the bleed in its stock end and the whole problem end and try to bring people to the table. I think it's an open question, though, if these potential buyers look at Lehman and say, you know, there's just too much toxic stuff here. We can't take the risk. We can't buy this thing. And Lehman is left once again with the prospect of a failure if the federal government doesn't kind of balk and say, okay, we'll come up with some kind of backstop for this stuff like we did for Bear and not let Lehman fail. We don't know that they will do that, but there will be a moment of truth at some point where they'll have to decide.
And that moment could come today. I don't want to put you on quiz bowl here, Ben, but can you give us a sense of the scale of a Lehman failure or Lehman bailout versus a Bear Stearns failure / bailout? How big is the bank? What are the assets we're talking about? And maybe the number of employees who would be affected.
Right. Well, it's about 25,000 employees in total at Lehman Brothers now. And if it's to be sold, certainly, the vast majority of those are likely to need to find work elsewhere. The big question is the systemic risk effect of a Lehman failure versus a Bear failure. There's about $30 billion in assets that the government wind up having to back up for Bear Stearns. It would probably actually be a larger number for Lehman Brothers.
Really?
And I think Lehman is just as deeply entwined in the system as Bear was, with derivative contracts with other banks, with relationships with hedge funds, with its relationships with a number of financial intermediaries. So I think the risk of an outright Lehman failure are probably as big, if not bigger, than they were for Bear.
So and perhaps the most cautionary part of this tale is that, unlike Bear, which had management problems, clear management problems, until this all happened, it was all white gloves at Lehman Brothers, right?
For the most part, I suppose. I mean, I think you certainly can, in retrospect now, fault a lot of decisions
yes.
that Lehman made.
It's a hindsight world on Wall Street today. Ben White, thanks so much for joining us.
Got it.
Ben White, financial reporter for The New York Times, reporting on what could be the moment of truth for Lehman Brothers on Wall Street.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hurricane Ike.
Hurricane Katrina.
Hurricane Gustav.
Faye, Gustav, Hannah, and Ike.
This monster of a storm.
Extreme weather.
Hurricane.
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 Yes, and once again, hundreds of thousands of Texans are fleeing Hurricane Ike as it barrels toward the central coastline. Stormy weather all around, but are all the hurricanes, tropical storms, tornadoes, and extreme weather we're seeing lately just random chance? Are these storm clusters normal seasonal cycles, or are humans and global warming causing more storms and more severe storms? Our guest, Carrie Emanuel, is a professor of atmospheric science at MIT and one of the earliest scientists to predict that global warming could create stronger storms. Professor Emanuel, thanks for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
You know, first of all, let's just give people a sense of the trends here in terms of frequency of storms and severity of storms. What are we seeing over the last 10, 15 years?
Well, in the Atlantic, the power of storms, the energy that they generate over their lifetimes, has nearly doubled in the last 20 years.
Wow. I mean, that's a huge number, but in terms of everything that's going on in the Atlantic climate-wise, is that a giant event? Is that a tiny little blip?
No, it's a very large change, and we're still struggling to grasp why that's so. We think that part of it is global warming. Part of it is a recovery from an era of suppressed activity in the 70s and 80s, and we now believe that actually we had a hand in that suppression too.
Really? How did we have a hand in the suppression?
Well, there is another phenomenon called global dimming, which is an actual cooling of the planet that is induced by very small particles that we put in the atmosphere, in this case sulfate aerosols, again a byproduct of fossil fuel combustion, and that demonstrably cooled the planet, particularly the northern hemisphere in that time, and seems to have had a hand in suppressing hurricanes during the 70s and 80s, which were very unusually quiet if you look at a very long-term record.
So particulates in the atmosphere blocked sunlight and sun energy getting to the northern hemisphere. That caused a dimming. Now we've cleaned up that in the atmosphere, but we're adding carbon, which is an input for global warming, and it's driving these storms to have higher energy levels. Is that sort of the cycle we're looking at?
That's right. What we see when we look at the data is, first of all, a very strong correlation between hurricane power and ocean temperature. And also we see an uptick in the proportion of hurricanes that reach the upper categories, that is 3, 4, and 5.
Is there a counter argument? Again, I think there are a lot of cycles at work here. There are many inputs to climate. It is a complex question to model. What would be the counter arguments that this maybe is just episodic and doesn't have to do with climate change?
Well, of course, one does see something that looks like cycles in the Atlantic, and I think some of us have come around to the idea that what we thought was a cycle was merely a kind of an up-down pattern caused by this combination of global dimming and global warming, so that my own feeling is that there's not that much evidence for cycles. But remember, the Atlantic only has about 12% of these storms. The rest of them are in the Pacific and Indian Oceans. And when we look there, we also see an increase in the proportion of the higher category events.
So the trend is global, and both in terms of frequency and severity, no matter where you go on the planet.
Well, the frequency and severity questions are very tangled up. The Cat 1s and 2s, the weaker storms in many areas, are actually going down. And in fact, the global frequency of events seems to be dropping a little bit, and in fact, models predict that it will continue to drop. But I have to emphasize that at least in the developed world, the ones and twos really don't matter. They don't do very much damage. They don't take very many lives. It's the upper categories one worries about.
So there's a lot of talk in the global warming inquiry that a couple of degrees a rise in the average temperature on planet Earth would produce catastrophic effects along coastlines, et cetera. What about an incremental increase in the energy of storms hitting the coast season after season? What sorts of direct impacts on architecture, on living conditions would that have?
Well, the destruction wrought by windstorms tends to go up with their power. But the question of hurricanes hitting coastlines is actually somewhat more complicated because global change also causes changes in the steering patterns, the winds that direct these storms. And this is an area where science hasn't converged. You know, it's possible that storms would tend to stay more offshore under global warming, or to hit them more systematically. I want to add one thing, though, that there is another robust prediction of global warming theory, is that a given storm is going to rain more. This is something pretty much everyone agrees on, and you have to remember that, especially in the developing world, it's the rain that kills. Hurricane Mitch in the late 1990s in Honduras killed about 12,000 people. Those were all from freshwater floods.
Wow. And of course, Ike is predicted to be a very slow-moving and large storm. And again, it's not so much the winds, but it is the storm surge and the tidal effects of the storm that authorities are really warning about. Carrie Emanuel, thank you very much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Carrie Emanuel is an atmospheric scientist and meteorologist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences. He joined us from Cambridge. And now joining us right here in the studio is Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thanks, John. Coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Picking up on Hurricane Ike, it's on course to hit Texas with devastating force later today. The National Weather Service has told residents in low-lying towns they face certain death if they don't evacuate. But authorities in Houston are urging people to stay put. They're trying to avoid the dangerous evacuation gridlock. The tunnel is closed today. That's the tunnel between England and Europe. That's because it's on fire. Officials say that the blaze broke out on a train yesterday on its way from England to France. 14 people were injured. Firefighters have the flames under control, but they haven't been able to put them out yet. In her first televised interview since being named on the GOP ticket, Sarah Palin says she's ready to be president if called upon. Charlie Gibson of ABC News asked Palin about what insight she's got into the situation with Russia. Palin said that you can actually see Russia from parts of Alaska, and that as a neighbor, she can deal with a former superpower. Thai Prime Minister Samak Sundaraj is on his way out. The country's ruling party decided not to renominate the ousted prime minister. He was in trouble for continuing to host a cooking show while in office. Parliament will hold a vote next week to pick a new prime minister.
Well, he can go back to the cooking show.
Well, he hasn't given the cooking show up, so it's
well,
always good to have a plan B.
Right. It's always good. Please continue.
I've seen him cooking. Yes. It's good that he has a plan B. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has kicked out the U.S. ambassador to his country. It's the latest move in a diplomatic tit-for-tat pitting the U.S. against the leftist country and its fellow leftist neighbor Bolivia. Venezuela has close ties with Russia. And Travel and Leisure magazine has their America's Favorite Cities. They took a look at 45 cities around the U.S. The most beautiful people are in Miami.
I see. Well, you're our plan B, Femi. Okay, thanks for... for that.
I'm your plan B?
Yeah, our plan B.
Be afraid.
Here at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer cash rewards to students for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it like merit bonuses in business? Viewpoints at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about actually playing some great music for hard times, music that pulled people out of really, really difficult times in world history. But what's the song that you can rely on? What's that song that brings you around when times are bad? We want to hear your song, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send it to us. Call us with your playlist, and we'll play some tunes on the air. My take at thetakeaway.org. Also, what do you think Sarah Palin needs to be asked? If you watched the Charlie Gibson interview last night, what do you think still needs to be asked? What should have been asked better? What shouldn't have been asked? Anything that you want to say as a takeaway from that interview at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But history in Zimbabwe, after 7 weeks of talks and years of political tension, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai and President Robert Mugabe have reached what looks like a breakthrough power-sharing government. And that comes after some very, very tense talks and, of course, violence following the election. Joining us to talk about Tsvangirai's participation and what the outlines of this agreement actually are is Ebson Mukwevesi, who is the Movement for Democratic Change's Europe spokesman. That's Tsvangirai's party. He joins us from London. Ebson, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
First of all, this is a I was actually discussing what the agreement was seeming to move towards yesterday with someone from the BBC. It seems as though maybe this country is going to have two heads rather than one. Describe how this power sharing is going to work.
It's an agreement that was arrived at, after consultations with the three parties, political parties in Zimbabwe. And we hope that Zimbabweans will feel relieved now that there is going to be peace in the country and that the ruinous economy is going to be revived with the support from our international friends.
Clearly, the consensus among the people in Zimbabwe is to have peace and to have the economy move forward. But at some point, the official position of the opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, is that you folks won the election. You actually won the election the first time around. How do you continue working with Robert Mugabe when basically your party believes that it won the election?
To move forward, and we think Zimbabweans should be allowed to move forward. We have now decided that we should work together as one people and save lives, provide people with food, create jobs for the people of Zimbabwe, Zimbabweans will be pleased to know that their country will at last rejoin the international family.
Now, there's supposed to be a formal ceremony that will, at which point this agreement will be signed and the details will actually be worked out. Do you expect that Monday ceremony will take place?
Yes, it's going to take place on Monday at 10 o'clock Zimbabwean time. And over this weekend, the three parties would be working out the composition of the new government, but its priority would be to turn around the economy with food, with emphasis on food security. There's no doubt that the country will need huge foreign aid so that Zimbabweans can embark on a reconstruction program of their beautiful country. So, yes, come Monday, the signing ceremony will be held in Harare, and we hope that our regional and continental leaders will be present to witness this historical moment.
We're speaking with Ebson Mukwevesi, who's the Movement for Democratic Change's Europe spokesman. That's the opposition party of Morgan Tsvangirai, who's just signed an agreement or just announced an agreement for power sharing in Zimbabwe. You know, a lot of people, Ebson, suggested that after Morgan Tsvangirai pulled out of the runoff election because of the violence that was taking place, that Robert Mugabe really outplayed the opposition party in this chess game here. And I'm wondering if you're worried about the criticism that maybe by making a deal with Mugabe, you run the risk of being outfoxed again.
Morgan Tsvangirai is a seasoned politician. He's Zimbabwe's most courageous and most popular politician. We are happy with the way things have developed in Zimbabwe, and now that we have got an agreement in place, we are not going to look back and say because of the 29th election, because of the 27 one-man presidential runoff, therefore Zimbabweans are going to are going to remain enemies forever. We are saying, yes, there were problems. People died. People were maimed. Women were raped. Properties were destroyed. But it's time for Zimbabweans to come together. It's time for Zimbabweans to accept that there is need for coexistence as political parties. And we'll move on. And the country will recover from this economic and social crisis.
And that's a message for all Zimbabweans, black and white?
That's the message to Zimbabweans, black and white. Zimbabwe is Zimbabwe for all people, regardless of color, creed, religion, or whatever color. Zimbabweans are Zimbabweans. We don't believe in on the basis of color. We are saying Zimbabweans for Zimbabweans, white, yellow, color.
No, Barry,
is not important to us.
Hopeful, optimistic words from Ebson Mukwevezi. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ebson Mukwevezi is the Movement for Democratic Change, the Zimbabwe Opposition Party of Morgan Tsvangirai's spokesman in Europe, and commenting on the power-sharing agreement that was just announced after tense talks and much violence following the Zimbabwe elections. And now we're joined by Femi Oke for headlines.
Thank you very much, John. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Sarah Palin is defending her qualifications to be a heartbeat away from the nation's highest office. She told ABC that she's ready to be president if called upon. But Palin sidestepped on whether she had the national security credentials needed to be commander-in-chief. Fears of devastation are growing in Texas as hundreds of thousands along the coast flee in advance of Hurricane Ike. Forecasters are warning that the gigantic storm could produce a wall of water 20 feet high and waves of 50 feet. The storm is expected to make landfall this evening or tomorrow morning. Currently, the winds are around about 105 miles an hour, and it's a Category 2 hurricane.
Did you hear the scientists we spoke with in the last segment?
Yeah,
isn't
it's
that
fascinating.
Interesting? About
Very interesting.
The slow storms, the wet storms, that's mm-hmm. really the hard thing.
Yeah, and if the oceans are getting warmer, we're going to get bigger, stronger hurricanes because mm-hmm. it's the warm water that fuels the hurricanes.
Right.
Don't get me started on weather, John.
I know.
It's
like
you and science.
Make that mistake. Yeah,
I know.
That's right. It's bad.
20 minutes to the top of the hour. Still some time for some more news. Tensions are high between the U.S. and two South American countries, Bolivia and Venezuela. After accusing the U.S. of encouraging anti-government protests, Bolivia kicked out the U.S. ambassador. In return, the U.S. tossed Bolivia's ambassador out to Washington. And now Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has ordered the U.S. ambassador to his country. I hope you were keeping up with that. Basically, ambassadors have all gone home.
But it's an interesting story, though, actually, tensions in Latin America. There's a lot of transition. We're going to be talking about some Latin American history in just a moment.
Right. And the reason why we wanted to put it in the news, we didn't want one of those stories to just be a major headline from nowhere. So we actually wanted to make sure we were getting the build up to this story.
Well, thank you for that, Femi. And we will avoid talking of weather in the next segment. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. 2.5 years ago, the country of Chile made history.
Hubo tiempos de nuestra historia en que nos dividimos entre unos y otros. Nos miramos con recelo, suspicacia, soberbia.
Chilean President Michelle Bachelet speaking at her inauguration in 2006, talking about how the history of Chileans is one of division and mistrust. And some of that goes back to Chile's long, dark period 35 years ago, when thousands would die at the hands of a military government. In September 1973, socialist Salvador Allende was in his third year of his presidency. Allende won narrowly in a democratic election, the first Marxist to be elected president by popular vote in Latin America. He took the country to the left, nationalized private companies, instituted land reform, and made ties with communist nations. And his presidency was marked by spiraling inflation, food shortages, and violent strikes and demonstrations. An ambitious general saw an opening. His name, Augusto Pinochet. This is what followed.
Later news just in from Chile. A radio station says that guards at President Allende's palace in Santiago have surrendered, and rebel troops have given him only minutes in which to leave office.
La historia es nuestra, y la hacen los pueblos.
You're hearing the voice of Salvador Allende. I will pay with my life for the loyalty of the people, he said, and I say to you, they have the strength, but they will fail because they cannot stop the social process with crimes or force.
History is ours, Allende said. It is made by the people. Allende didn't make it out of the presidential palace alive. The death was ruled a suicide. Pinochet's military junta was now in control, as one admiral boasted.
We don't like killing anybody. Our armed forces are for defense against enemies from abroad, not inside. On the other hand, there's not many examples of countries getting rid of communism, so we are kind of a new experience, because if Spain got rid of communism, it was through a long war. For us, it only took us 6 hours.
Only 6 hours, perhaps because the coup reportedly had some important backers, which explains why. The U.S. government, in a press conference a year after the coup, President Gerald Ford denied helping Pinochet overthrow Allende.
Now, in this particular case, as I understand it, and there's no doubt in my mind, our government had no involvement whatsoever in the Allende coup. To my knowledge, no money has charged that. The facts are we had no involvement in any way whatsoever in the coup itself.
But documents that have come out over the years, including new ones this week, show private conversations between Kissinger and Richard Nixon about attempts to stop Allende from taking office and thwarting him once he did. Pinochet ruled Chile brutally for more than 2 decades. Thousands were murdered, tens of thousands more jailed, tortured, and exiled. Justice didn't catch up with Pinochet in time. He died in 2006, facing dozens of international charges and evading trial by citing his poor health. This week, Chileans look back. Here's Chilean Interior Minister José Miguel Insulza speaking yesterday.
Of course, everybody is sad when they remember the people who died on those days and the tremendous tragedy that followed, and the dictatorship, and precisely what we're working for is not to have this again.
In one of those ironies and narrative twists of history, 35 years later, Chile is led by another socialist, President Michelle Bachelet. As in Allende's words, history is ours. It is made by the people.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with headlines from Femi Oke.
Good morning. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Gas prices are rising over concern about cuts in supply because of Hurricane Ike. The hurricane is churning toward the petroleum refineries along the Gulf Coast. Many companies are stopping operations at refineries in Texas, mostly in the Houston area. Nearly 1 million people along the coast have been ordered to evacuate. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is leaving open the option of a war with Russia if it were to invade Georgia and if the Republic were a NATO ally. In her first televised interview since being tapped as John McCain's running mate, Palin said, "When you are a NATO ally, if another country is attacked, you're going to be expected to be called upon and help." Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin says that Georgia, and I quote, "deserves to be punched in the face," after it attacked South Ossetia last month. Mr. Putin rejected criticism that Russia used overwhelming force when it invaded Georgia. The brief war inflamed tensions between Russia and the West. And finally, our partners at the BBC are reporting on a story about kosher and non-kosher music. The ultra-Orthodox organisation called the Committee for Jewish Music has put together a blacklist of music and bands that are not kosher, which means that these musicians can't play at ultra-Orthodox weddings or public events because they're considered to be decadent. So here's the sound of traditional ultra-Orthodox music.
Cantor, yeah.
Just by way of comparison, this would be decadent, non-kosher music. Now, the rabbi who put together the non-kosher music list is saying that anything that has modern instruments, modern beats, it's immoral and doesn't help young people to become good, ultra-Orthodox Jews.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, it'd be interesting if the non-kosher playlist outsells the kosher playlist.
Yes.
That'd be interesting. Always. Anyway,
how's that for a slinky link into the next
Thank
segment?
Thank you, Femi,
you
very
like
much.
It?
Yes, indeed.
All right.
So have you noticed when the news gets really, really bad, the music on TV gets really, really bad? Television news uses music to evoke a mood, and we heard a lot of this kind of mood music, this sort of tragedy-inspired mood music on the anniversary of 9/11 this week. But great music can come out of tragedy. Often it inspires composers to create what really moves us. And all of this motivated our friend Terrence McKnight to join us this morning. He hosts a music program just down the hall from us here at WNYC. Terrence, you know good music. And you also know the sort of the history and the sort of mood and narratives that are tied up in a lot of the really most famous pieces of music. And I want to begin with Piano Concerto No. 2 of Rachmaninoff here. Let's just play a little bit. Dylan, this is a really famous piece. What was going on in Rachmaninoff's life before he wrote this?
This work, these notes that we're listening to, is a result of a guy who had such high expectations, and everybody had high expectations for him or from him because he was a child prodigy.
Right.
And went on to go to college at age 9 and graduated at 19. And his first symphony was such a flop that he left while the band was still playing.
Wow.
It was hard for him to show his face. It was hard for him to write music. He went almost 4 years without writing another piece, had to undergo psychotherapy. And through all of that, this is what he came out with.
Whoa.
After all, after those 4 years, this is the piece that he came out with. And I'll go on to say that part of the problem with his first symphony was not so much the music, but the conductor was supposedly on the podium drunk.
But that always is bad. Yeah.
And the orchestra was uninspired. Yeah.
But the symphony was a head piece. This is a heart piece. Let's move a little bit later in the concerto and tell us what's significant about this part here.
Well, you can see, you can hear in this music that Rachmaninoff has gotten his confidence back. I mean, the orchestra's going to join him in this big celebration. Yeah, so he's got his confidence back. He's at the piano. The orchestra is with him, and this actually became a pop song.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. It's a Barry Manilow tune, right?
Full Moon and Empty Arms, something like that. Yeah.
We will spare our audience by not playing the.
And we won't sing it either.
Right. We won't sing it either. Right. Oh, it's a great tune. But fade that down for a second. I just want to take 2 seconds and say, you know, when I lost a girlfriend one time before I got married, there was nothing that would help me except for this song here. This song, Disney tune, Beauty and the Beast. I would get drunk and listen to this song and weep. And that's enough of that. Why does that work, Terrence?
Well,
why does that stuff
obviously
work?
You were the beauty, John.
Right. But we use, I mean, we embrace music, even bad music, to just get us through these rough times. And it's amazing how emotionally charged music can be.
Well, and that's why I brought you these examples, because, John, we have to know that there are some people out there lonely. I mean, if you go to Craigslist and look at personals, you'll see how many lonely people there are out there, as well as other personals. And, you know, people are having hard times with, you know, all that's going on. So music,
let's hear a peep of this Aretha Franklin that you played a moment ago, Dylan.
Another source of comfort.
Yeah.
Now, this is a little more direct than the Rachmaninoff. In trouble.
You need some love and
care. That is so great.
Ain't nothing going right.
Now, what she's setting up here, John, is a piece by Thomas Dorsey written in 1932, a tune called Precious Lord. Here, Thomas Dorsey, another guy similar to Rachmaninoff. He was very talented. He had a troubled kind of a childhood, dropped out of school, moved to Chicago, and started studying music. Well, he had started studying music when he was in Atlanta, but he studied music in Chicago and went on to become the father of gospel music. He started working with singers like Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey, Mahalia Jackson. And in the midst of all of that, he had a nervous breakdown, and he decided that he was not going to write blues anymore, that he was going to write religious music, spiritual music, gospel music. And his wife and his child died during childbirth, and he wrote a tune called his very... You hear it right here. Precious Lord, take my hand.
Well, I feel
400 compositions this guy composed. But this is probably
this is the one.
The one.
Yeah. Well, you chose an amazing tune that I've known for a long time. Oliver Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time, which was written under some also pretty amazing circumstances of history.
8 years later. Olivier Messiaen,
right.
French composer who joined the French army. He wanted to fight, but he had bad eyesight. Right. And so he became like a medical orderly. Well, he was captured by the Germans, sent to a prison camp, and found other musicians in the prison camp. And when they found Messiaen, he didn't have like a syringe or bandages. He had musical scores on him. And
I understand that the instrumentation in this quartet is just what was available at the POW camp.
Right. He found a cellist. He found a violinist. He found a clarinetist. And he was a pianist. So he put together this piece called Quartet for the End of Time. And these POWs performed this piece in front of a few hundred guards and other prisoners of war in 1941.
Wow. Lastly, and I could go for another hour with you, but we have Shostakovich, Symphony No. 7. There's nobody more brooding than Shostakovich. Take us out with this.
1941, his city, Leningrad, was being invaded by the Germans. Shostakovich wrote this four-movement piece. Nearly a million people in Leningrad had been killed because of starvation, because of air raids, and Shostakovich stayed around, and he wrote this symphony with all of that stuff going on. He stayed in the city, wrote this symphony. He called the last movement Victory initially, and you get a sense that the victory doesn't come immediately, but you have to wait for it. You hear brooding, building up, building up, building up.
Wow. Terrence, you are the beauty. I am the beast. Thanks for joining us today on The Takeaway. I hear victory. Does not get better than that. Thank you, Terrence.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Aim, fire, ready?
On January 20th, when John McCain and I are sworn in, if we are so privileged to be elected to serve this country, we'll be ready. I'm ready.
Sarah, Sarah, so easy to look at, so hard to define.
Sarah Palin has been dominating the presidential campaign for a week now, and someone finally got the chance to ask her if she's ready to be president. Rough and readiness, knowns and unknowns. The governor of Alaska meets the press. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. It's Friday, September 12th. I'm John Huckenberry. Adoree Udoji is away. We're looking at a new business model in network television this morning. Also, a baseball season with a busload of Cinderella stories. And what happens when you give scientists a few billion dollars? The joy of science projects, not the ones in your refrigerator. Those stories and more, but first, some headlines. Texas is bracing for a devastating hit from Hurricane Ike. It's expected to hit later tonight or early tomorrow. The storm could push a 20-foot-high wall of water through coastal towns and bring 50-foot waves with it. Texas Governor Rick Perry told coastal residents that they could face death if they don't get out in time.
I cannot overemphasize the danger that is facing us. It's going to do some substantial damage.
Hurricane Ike actually fills the Gulf of Mexico. General David Petraeus, the outgoing commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, says things are improving there, but that could change.
The progress here is fragile. It is reversible. It's not yet self-sustaining.
Petraeus says he doesn't think he'll ever use the word victory in Iraq. Sarah Palin's first interview since she became John McCain's running mate aired last night. Palin told ABC's Charlie Gibson that she didn't hesitate for a second when McCain asked her to join the ticket. Gibson interviewed Palin in Alaska. An historic day in Zimbabwe. Last night, President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai finally reached a power-sharing agreement after months of violent aftermath of the election in Zimbabwe. Good morning, Femi Oke. How am I doing here?
Hello there, John. Not too bad. A couple of other stories still following on the news today. Investment giant Lehman Brothers is for sale. The fourth largest investment bank in the U.S. tried to convince shareholders it could stay afloat, but it started looking for a buyer after another day of hemorrhaging value. Share prices have dropped more than 90% since the beginning of the year.
I actually saw it on Craigslist. There, politics today, what's going on?
And in politics, we have Barack Obama. He's campaigning in New Hampshire. John McCain is making the rounds on television. He's appearing with his wife Cindy on The View and Rachel Ray today.
The oil price is about $101 a barrel in Asian trading. The Dow ended at 11,433 yesterday, and the S&P is set to open at 1249. The market's poised to open lower. When all else fails, there's music. Tell us your mood-changing music, the song that you can count on in tough times at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And you're already responding to the Sarah Palin interview on ABC last night with Charles Gibson. What did you take away from the interview? What questions did Charlie Gibson not ask? What would you have asked her? All right, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Do you have a question for Sarah Palin, Femi? Do you? Come on, you must have one.
You have one. Can I tell you later?
Tell me later.
All right.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Huckenberry and Adoree Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As we noted at the top of the hour, she could be eventually a heartbeat away from the presidency. But last night, Sarah Palin, the governor of Alaska, the vice presidential running mate of John McCain, met the press in the form of ABC's Charlie Gibson in an interview broadcast on ABC World News tonight and throughout the evening. She's also going to be on Good Morning America this morning. She defended her qualifications to be president, if that should ever be necessary. And joining us now is David Mark, senior editor for Politico.com. David, you know, there's been a suspicion that the McCain campaign has been really rationing press access to Sarah Palin in the days after she was named the running mate. But this was a face-to-face, no holds barred, no ground rules interview with Charlie Gibson. What have you learned about her, and what remains an unknown about Sarah Palin at this point?
Well, I think what we learned is that she is a headstrong person. She is somebody that does not lack confidence. It was clear in her convention acceptance speech, in the limited public appearances she's had so far, And she said she wants to get across the point that she's ready to take over as vice president and potentially president if need be. And voters, we'll see if they agree with that sentiment or not.
We got a sense of her sort of tactical echoes, I suppose, of the themes of John McCain. I mean, certainly one of John McCain's challenges, and you've talked about this before, is the need to distance himself from President Bush without repudiating the entire Republican agenda. Here's Sarah Palin addressing a question about what she thinks of the Bush doctrine.
I believe that what President Bush has attempted to do is rid this world of Islamic extremism, terrorists who are hell-bent on destroying our nation. There have been blunders along the way, though.
So she distances but supports the general scheme of President Bush. How do you think she handled that?
That's probably about as good as she could do. That is, as you say, that is almost exactly in line with what John McCain's been saying for the last several years. I'm not sure a lot of voters are necessarily going to buy that sentiment because it still leaves a lot of questions about preemptive invasions like Iraq and other such situations. So there's a lot more debate there, a lot more fodder for debate, but I think she handled it about as well as she could have.
And Charlie Gibson was pretty tough with her there, but let's move on to an issue that John McCain doesn't talk about much at all. Here's Palin being asked about a comment that's appeared widely on the Internet regarding the mission in Iraq being some sort of task that is from God. Here's her answer.
The reference there is a repeat of Abraham Lincoln's words when he said, first he suggested, never presume to know what God's will is. And I would never presume to know God's will or to speak God's words. But what Abraham Lincoln had said, and that's a repeat in my comments, was, let us not pray that God is on our side in a war or any other time, but let us pray that we are on God's side.
All right, here's a multiple choice, Mark. Was that candid? Was that an elaboration, or was that a sidestep?
I'd say sidestep, the last one. That is very treacherous ground for politicians to be walking on. President Bush, of course, was accused of kind of a messianism or shortly after 9/11 and saying he had God on his side or whatever the quote was. And I think that's something that the McCain-Palin campaign would rather move away from as quickly as possible.
Well, it's probably going to come back if she has more access to the press, and more about that will be on other ABC programs over the next couple of days. When asked about national security, she took a curious tack. She focused on her experience with the dealing with energy. Here's what she said there.
I want you to not lose sight of the fact that energy is a foundation of national security. It's that important. It's that significant.
I mean, they're betting there that most Americans, you know, really don't care about foreign affairs in the details, but are focused on energy and know about Middle East oil and that sort of thing. Are they right?
Yeah. Well, that's a kind of a complicated argument. There may be some merit to what she's saying, but she really has not dealt with geopolitical issues the way that it's being discussed in this campaign. So I would expect she's going to get pressed about that a lot more. And I would also expect the Obama campaign will see that as a weak sign and try and hone in on that a little bit more.
All right. Well, before we go, can you just generally sort of sum up your sense of what we still need to know about Sarah Palin, or are we pretty? Do we have a much more complete picture now?
I think we have the start of a picture, but there is a whole lot more to ask. There's much more about foreign affairs. She referenced making the country of Georgia a member of NATO, which of course would have policy problems with Russia, as we all know. There's a lot more specific foreign affairs issues. And I think the Obama campaign probably saw some areas of weakness that they can go after here. And the press, too, just doing our jobs. There's a lot more questions to ask.
But, I mean, were you like dying to know what Dan Quayle thought of Georgia? I mean, what's different about Sarah Palin here? I mean, do we really need to know her foreign policy experience? Or is she just getting hosed because she's a woman and she's really self-confident and she's really drawn a line in the sand?
I don't think it's a woman thing. I think this it would be the same questions for any vice presidential candidate. I don't think it's about specific answers to policy questions. It's whether it's a threshold question. Does she have the broad grasp of geopolitics to take over as commander-in-chief if necessary? Maybe so. Maybe voters will decide that she does. It's just there's a lot of unanswered questions still.
Well, David Mark, thanks for taking us through that interview. It's really fascinating, and there is, as you say, a lot more to know. David Mark, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
David Mark is a senior editor for Politico.com. Politico.com, your source, our source, certainly, for political analysis. Now we turn to Hurricane Ike, which is bearing down on the Texas coast. Nearly a million people have been ordered to evacuate ahead of the hurricane. Joining us now is Paul Pendergraft, senior producer for news and public affairs at public radio station KUHF. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John. How are you?
You know, I'm fine, but in looking at the National Weather Service pronouncements and Homeland Security pronouncements about Hurricane Ike, I don't think I've heard language like this. This is a really alarming, you know, maybe a little bit reminiscent of Nagin in New Orleans the other week saying, mother of all storms here. How are you feeling down in Houston?
Well, we don't want to call it the mother of all storms, but this is serious, a very dangerous storm, John. There's no question about it. Right now, it's kind of a freak of a storm in that it only is a Category 2, but it's a monster storm. From the center of the storm out to the edges, it's about 230 or 240 miles, and there's tropical storm winds that entire space. Currently, as we speak this morning, Hurricane Ike, even though it's a Category 2 storm, has a larger wind field, and it has moved more water than Katrina did. So there's potential for extreme damage along the Texas coast because of historical storm surges, some places in excess of 20 feet.
Now, Paul, I have relatives down in the Houston area. Whenever I visit, I mean, a tiny rainstorm produces floods up to the door sills on my rental car. I mean, it seems like Houston is really vulnerable to massive flooding here.
There's no question, and this is going to be a rainmaker. We're going to have 5 to 10 inches of rain, but there's one redeeming quality, if it can be considered that. This storm is actually going to move very fast. It's going to come onshore, and it's going to move across the area very quickly. It's going to drop a lot of rain, but it's not going to sit there and just continue to dump rain. And there's flooding. There's going to be flooding. There's no question, because, as you know, when there's no storm surge, our bayous flood. Well, the bayous are going to be blocked because of the storm surge, so there's going to be inland flooding as well. And people are anticipating it, but I don't think they can truly appreciate the amount of water that they're going to have to experience.
Hmm. Well, how's the evacuation going before we go?
It truly went well. Our nightmare 3 years ago with Hurricane Rita was the worst of all situations, and we learned a lot of lessons there. People who didn't need to evacuate this time, most of them have not. And a lot of people who got stuck in those traffic jams decided to just hunker down at home. There were still several hundred thousand people that got out in a pretty orderly fashion. There was enough gasoline to get everybody out. So this has been, as all evacuations can go, this one went pretty well.
Well, Paul Pendergraft, senior producer for news and public affairs at KUHF Houston Public Radio, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure, John. My best to you.
All right, and we will talk to you after the storm. Thanks so much. On Sarah Palin, we spoke to Mark about that moments ago. Here's a response from you. Since Sarah Palin and John McCain would use the power of the executive office to see that Roe v. Wade is overturned by way of judicial appointments, I'd like to know this from Palin, asks Joanna from New York. Once abortion is criminalized, what will be the punishment for women found guilty of having or seeking an abortion? What's your question for Sarah Palin? 877-8-MY-TAKE. And mytake at thetakeaway.org. You can reach us in both places. Also, we want to know what music, what tune do you rely on in hard times? What's the music that never fails to bring you around? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or, as I just said, mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
You remember the question I was asking this morning, right? What's the song that gets you through hard times?
Hi, my name is Marty. I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts. You've Got a Friend by Carole King, sung by Carole King, or James Taylor. That's the song.
You've got a friend. You've got yourself a friend now.
Hey now, baby.
Hey, we got them both for you, Marty. That's James Taylor and Carole King. You can share your song, the song that brings you around, at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So, a business story now. NBC shows like The Office and Heroes are now back on sale at the iTunes store. Check your computer. It's true. They haven't been available for nearly a year after NBC balked at how Apple priced each episode and generally had a strategy of protecting its content from the internet rather than distributing its content to the internet. It's a significant deal for the two companies, but it's an even bigger deal for the future of television on the internet. Nancy Miller from Wired Magazine is on the line. By the way, Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And, you know, let's talk about the significance of this deal. You know, Jeff Zucker was all over, the president of NBC Universal was all over talking about how, you know, what we want is our content to be on all platforms after years of saying just the opposite. What's going on here, do you think?
You know, it's funny. I was at the keynote conversation with Steve Jobs when he announced this, and everybody gasped in the audience.
Really?
I think people were really surprised that NBC was coming back to iTunes. But, the market has spoken. iTunes has a huge, huge revenue base for NBC. So they kind of, you know, made a good move in coming back.
You know, NBC has described itself as a content company, also a marketing company. And it seems that this new internet strategy is about using the internet to market content and using, institutions like Google to actually help broker its ad sales. I mean, this is a real change in the interactivity between television networks and the internet. What's going on here way beyond NBC?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, with NBC alone, they had a partnership with Fox with Hulu, and they are working with Google on monitoring ads for ad revenue. I'm not sure what you mean by more than NBC, but.
It seems to me that the biggest, you know, one of the biggest networks, certainly, you know, GE, the giant company GE, has decided to make a bet that putting your content everywhere actually floats all boats. And, Jeff Zucker yesterday didn't seem to be concerned at all about losing the free content sites like Hulu, even though they were going on to iTunes.
Well, you know, free is one thing. I mean, they are putting their content on Hulu, but they're generating advertising revenue from that. So they're looking at a couple of different models. A year ago, NBC, along with a lot of other TV networks, were obsessed with piracy. That seems to have gone away in the last year. You're absolutely right, where they do want a multi-platform opportunity. They want to be able to have their stuff seen everywhere. But it's based on a few different models. With iTunes, it was the a la carte. It was a pay-per-click. You could download it for $1.99. Now they want to do another model, which is advertising. With Amazon Unbox, which is something that they also tried, it was a subscription base. So it's looking at a variety of different business models in order to generate revenue.
You know, remember the old days when analysts would get on television and say it's either going to be a subscription model or it's going to be an advertising model? What NBC seems to be saying here is there are people who like to buy on iTunes because they're iTunes people, and then there are people who like to go to the card table, you know, down in Times Square and buy it from the, you know, Chinese guys selling the pirated stuff. There's a different market for all these distribution models.
Well, it seems like that right now. You know, it's funny, at Wired we talk about that a lot. In fact, we used to speak about it in this way. What's going to win out, the ad model, the subscription model, or the a la carte model?
The answer is yes. They all are.
I Absolutely, and I think that NBC and other networks are exploring that in a way they haven't necessarily before. You probably know this, but in the TV upfronts, a lot of the advertising that was generated was done in these packages, these bundles. So that was not only just the TV advertising, but also NBC was offering their advertisers opportunities online. So there was a lot of these bundle packages that generated a lot of revenue for the networks, and maybe in a way they hadn't seen before.
And that was actually one of the headlines out of the Olympics. I mean, NBC used the Olympics and all the sort of flow-through on the Internet sites where you could see the Olympics to sell ad packages all the way through. I mean, they actually created new advertising products that never existed before. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the role of NBC seems so, their emphasis on DRM, you know, digital rights management, their fear of piracy, and their obsession with Apple, the way that they ran their profit margins of not charging enough for their shows, that seems to have gone away. I mean, but think about this. I mean, Apple announced that they're going to charge a dollar more for HD TV. So now they have a high def feature on iTunes, so you can see, you know, The Office on your Nano and high def. So that's actually an extra dollar that iTunes can be charging that maybe appealed to NBC.
So have you downloaded all the episodes of 30 Rock yet?
It's funny that you say that. I'm still, you can actually, I watch Hulu for 30 Rock as much as I can. I also DVR 30 Rock when I can. That's my absolute favorite show. So I'll take that show anywhere I can get it.
Right. Well, Nancy Miller, thanks so much. Senior editor for Wired Magazine, thanks for joining us and explaining it all to us. NBC, of course, making a deal on iTunes to sell its content after saying for so long, no, 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 we don't like the prices. It's a changing world in the media. We can rely on Femi Oke here with the headlines.
Hello there. 28 minutes past the hour. Good morning. Houston residents are boarding up their windows and stocking up on drinking water. Authorities are urging people in America's fourth largest city not to flee. Hurricane Ike is making a beeline for the Texas coast and could hit with terrifying force. But officials fear that a mass evacuation could make people actually less safe. More than 100 people died in the gridlock that happened when people tried to escape Hurricane Rita. That was back in 2005. Sarah Palin told Charlie Gibson that she's ready to be president in an interview that aired on ABC last night. But Alaska governor sidestepped questions about her national security credentials. She emphasized that plenty of vice presidents haven't met foreign heads of state or done much travel outside of the US. The fire in the tunnel is out. The blaze in the tunnel linking France and England broke out yesterday. Firefighters have been battling the blaze for 16 hours. Service in both directions is still suspended. And the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, has kicked out the U.S. ambassador to his country. It's the latest move in a diplomatic tit-for-tat, pitting the U.S. against the leftist country and its fellow leftist neighbor, Bolivia. Venezuela has close ties with Russia, and the fourth largest oil supplier to the U.S. is Venezuela. That's a look at your news. I wonder if Charlie Gibson could ask Sarah Palin what's her piece of music for Hard Times.
That's the question you would want for her?
No, I have other questions. I do have other ones.
No, that is a good one. What would be her hard time? You say she's having no hard times these days.
Yeah.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer cash rewards to students for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it like merit bonuses in business? Viewpoints at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Last night, I'm sure some of you saw it, Sarah Palin gave an exclusive interview to ABC's Charlie Gibson. What did you take away from it?
Good morning. This is Chris from Brooklyn. Regarding Sarah Palin, I was shocked that she did not know what the Bush Doctrine was. It is part of the reason why her son was being deployed. And I cannot believe that somebody aspiring to the office of vice president under a 72-year-old man with health problems doesn't understand this stuff or doesn't know this stuff.
What did you think? What does Sarah Palin need to be asked? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. It's Friday, and with only 17 games left in the regular season, the Red Sox face an uphill battle to win the AL East. They lost 2 of 3 to division-leading Tampa Bay this week, which is the story of the baseball season. Boston is 2.5 games behind the Rays, who open a weekend series tonight against the Yankees, who look to be out of it. But there's a lot going on in the baseball season, and Dave Zirin joins us now from outside of Washington, D.C., sports writer for The Nation. Dave, that's your theme music. What do you think?
I love it.
You love it?
I love it. I'm here throwing punches and shadow boxing. It's amazing.
All right, that's nice. So you're flacking a book, you come to the studio, no book, you're on the phone. Okay. Message received, Dave.
Yeah, that's about right.
All right. So Babe, what's going on? You said the Rays were the story, the amazing story. I mean, they had such a week. Describe to me the moments, the baseball moments that the Rays have experienced just in this week.
Oh, it's remarkable. And first of all, just so in case you have some casual baseball fans, yes, before this season they were known as the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. This year they are just known as the Tampa Bay Rays. And I think we're all seeing the advantages of renouncing Satan on your record.
Yes,
they're doing
indeed.
A great job this year.
And they're a young team. They're a low-paid team. Nothing like the Red Sox or the Yankees.
Yeah, nothing. But this is, you know, this is the fruits of what happens when you're the worst-run baseball franchise for a decade. I mean, the Tampa Bay Rays have been absolutely terrible their first 10 years of existence. But in the process, what they've been able to do is stockpile an astounding amount of fantastic young talent. And if you couple that with some really good trades, then for the young baseball fan, people like Evan Longoria, Goria and Scott Kazmaier. I mean, these are the names of the future.
Oh, well, they're certainly the names of the present. And speaking of Cinderella stories, I mean, we can drag the tiredest, oldest Cinderella story in baseball is the Chicago Cubs. Here they are.
That's true, and I'm just back from Chicago. And let me just say, I've never seen a city of fans where people act like they're in a chair that's tipping over and that somebody is about to just knock them right down to the floor. I mean, the Chicago Cubs, they have been leading their division all season. They've had a terrible week this week, but then again, everyone else in their division has had a terrible week as well. And it's just a whole fan base that seems to be waiting for the other shoe to drop, waiting for the Steve Bartmans of the world. He was the guy in 03, of course, who messed up the team when they looked like they were making it to the World Series by grabbing the ball away from Moises Alou in the playoffs. So,
hey, Dave, I was there in 84 when the Cubs made the playoffs and then lost 4 straight to the Padres. So, you know, the Chicago, it's not over till it's over in Chicago.
Yeah. It's not over till it's over, but it's a bad feeling when people feel like it's over before it's even begun.
Yeah, that's true. So what other, you know, the Minnesota Twins are a smidge away from the White Sox in the AL Central, and the Dodgers could actually make it here.
Yeah, I mean, the Dodgers are a good story as well because they brought in Manny Ramirez. And I'm speaking this for the casual fan out there who's listening. Manny Ramirez, if you don't know him, he's kind of like the Rain Man of hitters, Manny being Manny. They call him the hitter savant. He walks up in the batter's box, and before you know it, he's just lacing line drives left and right. Bringing in Manny Ramirez has changed the attitude of the owner, Frank McCourt, who is going to fire their general manager by the end of this year. It's changed the attitude of the clubhouse, and it's making Joe Torre, I know New York fans remember Joe Torre, manager of the Dodgers, who's the sleepy-eyed genius, is starting to look like a genius once again.
Well, I think for New York fans, all the pain of the Yankees, you know, and what of that pain is not assuaged by the Mets, who look like they're going to make the playoffs, although, you know, they had such a collapse last year. New Yorkers are going to love Torre in the postseason. Talk about the Mets for a minute. You're a Mets fan, right?
I'm a Mets fan. You know that.
Yep.
I was raised in the 1980s in New York City. I mean, I practically have an orange NY tattooed on my back. My mom wouldn't let me do that, but still, I would have.
It's a lot of information there, Dave.
A little too much info.
A little bit, yeah.
But Carlos Delgado, out of nowhere, you know, one of those baseball players who's older than I am. And every time a player is now older than me, I'm now old enough that I'm thinking to myself, maybe they should be thinking about other work. But Carlos Delgado, he spent the last 2 months of this season looking like an MVP candidate after spending the last 2 years looking like he was really out of it and really couldn't play anymore.
But so they lost Wagner. They don't have a closer.
No, they've lost Wagner, and they've blown more saves in the second half of this season than every other division leader combined. It's an amazing statistic.
So and you want to handicap the series at this point, or just do the playoffs?
Oh, I'd like to handicap the series. I mean, I'll tell you this. This is what I said at the halfway point of the season, and I'd like to stick with it. At the start of the season, I predicted Angels-Mets, and that's looking very good. I know, and when I say Mets, I'm a ridiculous homer. But at the halfway point of the season, I said Rays-Mets, and I'm starting to feel that that's looking very right.
Oh, I'd prefer Rays-Mets. Dave Zirin, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my privilege. Thanks so much.
Dave Zirin, sports writer for The Nation, with now his own theme song. Can we hear just a little bit of that? A little bit of theme song? Dave Zirin theme? No, we can't. Okay, so let's just throw it to Femi. Okay, save the show, will you, Femi, with the headlines?
Yeah, I love that Gary Glitter anthem, but it's kind of banned in the UK. 21 minutes to the top of the hour, but perfect for sports. Meanwhile, back on the news headlines, Sarah Palin says that she's ready to lead as John McCain's vice president. In her first television interview since being tapped by the Republican Party, Palin sounded mostly confident. She talked tough about Russia, Iran, and the threat of terrorist attacks. Terrified residents of the Texas coastline are fleeing in advance of Hurricane Ike. Forecasters warn that the gigantic storm could produce a wall of water 20 feet high, and the storm is expected to make landfall this evening or tomorrow morning. After 7 weeks of hard negotiation, a power-sharing agreement has been reached between the Zimbabwean president, Robert Mugabe, and the leading opposition figure, Morgan Tsvangirai. The deal was announced by President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, who mediated it. And we've just been talking about sports with Dave Zirin. The Paralympics Games are happening right now in Beijing. The latest as far as the medals are concerned, the gold medals. China, 15, Great Britain, 16, and the US, 6 gold medals so far. But one Paralympic...
China is cleaning up.
Yeah, they're doing really well. But Great Britain's not far behind, and we're going on golds this time. Not total numbers of medals, but golds here. Got the unfortunate story of one Paralympian athlete who's in peak form, but he's been left disappointed. He's a soccer player who plays for Ireland. His name is Dara Malone. He has cerebral palsy, but he's disqualified from the games because he's actually too good. But Malone says that being in peak physical condition has kept him in good shape.
It's been a body blow. It's been 4 years training full-time for Beijing. With CP, the nature, like, it's non-progressive. But if you stop training, the functional deficits, meaning flexibility, coordination, skill retention, they regress pretty quickly. So you always have to keep on top of things.
And cerebral palsy is a neuromuscular condition.
Sure. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Victory in Iraq.
Victory in Iraq within sight.
Victory in honor.
That is victory.
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 Coming victory in Iraq.
Well, victory may be on the minds and lips of politicians, but it's not exactly what's going on in Iraq, at least according to General David Petraeus. He's the commander in Iraq, and on the BBC program Newsnight, he spoke on that program, the BBC, on September 11th. It was his last interview as the top U.S. military commander in Iraq, and it was with the BBC. It was tough. It was informative. It was interesting. And, of course, General Petraeus is moving on to a new job as head of Central Command. Newsnight correspondent Mark Urban asked General Petraeus about what we may be able to call the result in Iraq when U.S. troops leave.
Do you think you'll ever use the word victory?
I don't know that I will. I think that all of us at different times have recognized the need for real restraint in our assessments, in our pronouncements, if you will. And we have tried to be very brutally honest and forthright in what we have provided to Congress, to the press, to ourselves. And in fact, we say that you have to be first with the truth. You try to beat the bad guys to the headline, but it has to be the facts.
A refreshing candor and clarity there. Well, John McCain and Barack Obama marked the 7th anniversary of 9/11 in New York yesterday, but the situation in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, 7 years after that terrorist attack, is changing radically. And Petraeus was asked how it's possible to classify the U.S. war on terror these days.
And would you hope that the next administration would abandon phrases like war on terror?
This is a task that is very enduring. There will be progress in some fronts and setbacks in others. It's going to be a long struggle.
Petraeus says it's not about global safety, really. And he says that the U.S. in Iraq is performing a service, almost a humanitarian mission.
1 year ago, exactly, you were asked by Senator Warner in the Armed Services Committee whether what you were doing here made America safer. You said various things in reply, but at one point you said, "I don't know." Do you still feel that way? Do you feel that what you've...
I don't, actually. And what I did, in fact, state was we are involved in a hugely important endeavor in Iraq. It's important not just to Iraq, the region, but to the United States and the world.
And here Petraeus says that the fighting in Afghanistan isn't going in the right direction.
Do you see now the president's announcement this week rebalancing slightly troop numbers between here and Afghanistan as heralding a new trend, possibly even a surge, to use that word, in Afghanistan, a shift of focus?
I mean, there's no question but that the trends have not gone in the right direction in Afghanistan, that there have been challenges emerging, particularly this year, that are serious and have to be dealt with, and certainly the direction of forces, some of which would have come here, is, in fact, an answer, in part, to the challenges in Afghanistan.
And you can hear the challenges in his voice. That's from Newsnight, the BBC broadcast, aired on September 11th, 2008. General David Petraeus. Moving on to Command, Central Command.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Let's start with headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Gasoline prices are rising over concern about cuts in supply because of Hurricane Ike. The hurricane is churning toward petroleum refineries along the Gulf Coast. Many companies are stopping operations at refineries in Texas, mostly in the Houston area. Nearly 1 million people along the coast have been ordered to evacuate. Foreclosure filings last month increased 27% compared to the same time a year ago. But according to Realty Track, that pace was significantly slower than the two previous months. Nationwide, more than 300,000 homes received at least one foreclosure-related notice in August. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is leaving open the option of a war with Russia if it were to invade Georgia and if the Republic were a NATO ally. In her first televised interview since being tapped as John McCain's running mate, Palin said, "When you are a NATO ally, if another country is attacked, you're going to be expected to be called upon and help." And Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin says that Georgia, and I quote here, deserved to be punched in the face after it attacked South Ossetia last month. Mr. Putin rejected criticism that Russia used overwhelming force when it invaded Georgia. The brief war inflamed tensions between Russia and the West. And right now, talks about South Ossetia and Abkhazia having EU monitors have currently broken down. And finally...
Come on, everybody! Clap your hands!
That's Chubby Checker's song, The Twist. It's been named the biggest US chart hit of the last 50 years. The news comes as Billboard's Hot 100 celebrates 50 years old. And the song that might surprise you is that it's how long it's been in the charts and how popular it was at the time, not the number of actual singles sold.
And it makes people feel better.
It does.
That's right.
Go on our playlist for today.
Yes, indeed. All morning long we've been asking, you know, what songs get you through hard times? And, of course, you have all kinds of answers.
To the question, what songs bring me comfort in hard times? My answer, Aquarians.
dawning of the new age.
That's right. Let the sun shine in, folks. You can share your song at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You know, Sarah Palin's song is Anchorage by Michelle Schacht.
Ah, that's a good one.
There
who picked that? Was that one of our listeners or you?
No, it's me.
Oh, Mr.
That's
Clevington.
Me. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
All right, so if you've been paying attention to the news, you know about the 17-mile-long, particle-smashing Large Hadron Collider over there under the border between Switzerland and France. It's a multi-billion-dollar science project. It's supposed to give us new insights into the nature of the early universe. It's about international cooperation. It's about billions and billions of dollars. But it's about the most basic thing that ever happens in science. Most of the results in science come from experiments, and experiments are rickety devices that are built in laboratories and get switched on, and somehow, some way, they provide us new insights into the universe. It's one of the most interesting and beautiful and unpredictable spheres of science, and here to talk about it is Robert Kreese, who's the author of The Prism and the Pendulum, the 10 Most Beautiful Experiments in Science. He's the chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Stony Brook University, and he's here in our studio. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, John.
I'm so excited to have you, because when they switched that machine on, I just thought of all the science fair projects and all the people who've, you know, built these little boxes that are supposed to do this or that. I mean, there's a classic kind of sense of joy about switching on an experiment that goes way back to the early days of science.
Yes, you can't it's something familiar to every science student, every science every high school student, as you said, who's built and gotten an experiment to work, and it's working the way it should, and you feel that it's a beautiful thing.
Part of it is designing the experiment that's actually going to show or test the proposition that you want tested. There's a beauty in that, and then part of it is actually building the machine itself. What are the 10 most beautiful experiments in science?
Well, I'm also a columnist for the magazine Physics World.
Sure.
And a few years ago, I was interested by the fact that scientists often use the word beauty a lot. It's a beautiful experiment, a beautiful result, and I was wondering whether this was a metaphorical use of the word beauty, or whether there was something more to it. So I asked scientists to give me lists of their most beautiful experiments, and I compiled a list of the 10 most beautiful from that. Hundreds of people responded.
And what was the top of the list?
Well, the first one, in chronological order, the most beautiful experiment was Eratosthenes' experiment to determine the circumference of the Earth. Eratosthenes was a Greek who lived in the 3rd century B.C., and with just a sundial and a measuring stick and elementary geometry. He lived just a little bit after Euclid. He was able to determine the circumference of the Earth. Now, think about that. That's using something as ephemeral as shadows,
right,
in order to determine something on a huge scale, something on a tiny scale to determine the dimensions of the world.
He uses the sundial to detect the curvature of the Earth and then calculates from the curvature what the circumference or the radius or, you know, might be, right?
Yeah, he uses the fraction of the shadow with respect to the circle of the sundial is the same as the fraction between where he was measuring and a place where the shadow of the where the sun was directly over the Earth to the dimension of the Earth itself. And he came up with a figure that was very close to the right figure.
So what's a more modern experiment that passes the beauty test here?
Well, the most beautiful experiment, according to my respondents, was an experiment that shows that quantum mechanics really is mysterious. That is, that things down there don't behave the way that things do up here.
This is the God actually does play dice, Einstein disappointment, you know, where he thought actually quantum mechanics couldn't be true, but this proved that, in fact, it is pretty strange.
Yes, an electron can pass through can go through two different places at once. It can travel through a tiny slit and two tiny slits simultaneously.
And how did a machine prove that without getting too technical?
Well, you know that there's something called an interference pattern that's
right,
made when objects travel through it, like a wave travels through two slits. There's a particular kind of pattern that's created on the other side. And what this experiment did, and it was done by a group of Italians in 1974 in a a Japanese scientist in 1989, is that you see this pattern emerging on the other side if you send through single electrons one at a time. And if you see it recreated, it's one of the spookiest things that you've ever seen.
And it says that it basically passed through two at once.
Yeah.
It's in two places at once.
With just a little bit of understanding the concept, it's remarkably spooky.
Galileo was pretty good at this.
Well, one of the top experiments was the Leaning Tower experiment, which was science historians have shown that it's not apocryphal. It probably really did happen.
And remind us of how that experiment went.
Well, he climbed to the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and he dropped two balls, one of which was much heavier than the other, and they arrived at the bottom at just about the same time.
And it dispelled the myth that actually a heavier object travels faster than a lighter object.
The Aristotelian notion that an object that's twice as heavy is going to travel twice as fast.
And, of course, that proved that the force of gravity is the same everywhere.
That gravity affects everything equally.
And that's well. What's your impression of the super collider as a beautiful experiment? It's kind of unwieldy, and you can't actually do it in your basement.
Well, that's an interesting question because of the 10 experiments that I described in my list, they were all tabletop experiments done by two or three people. And the question is, can you still have beautiful science in the age of big science? Can you still have beauty in the age of big science? But, you know, something like the Higgs is sort of like what Eratosthenes did, and it connects. It's something very tiny. It happens that
the Higgs boson, which is what they're detecting over there.
Is something very tiny and small, and yet it has implications for cosmology. It connects very tiny, the very small scale with the very large scale.
And I guess, Robert Crease, we should be happy that you can't actually produce black holes on a tabletop. That could have disturbing implications for our universe, probably, wouldn't you say?
That would have big implications, yes.
Robert Crease, thanks so much for joining us. He's the author of The Prism and the Pendulum, the 10 Most Beautiful Experiments in Science. He's also the chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Stony Brook University. Now, there's all kinds of ways you can catch up with us on The Takeaway. You can go to Facebook, Friend Feed, Twitter, iTunes, and thetakeaway.org, and all of those fit on your tabletop. Here's what one of you had to say.
It's Mark from White Plains calling about a song I'd like to hear. After listening to Sarah Palin and hearing about a storm slamming into Port Arthur, Texas, I'd like to hear a song from a woman who's really speaking from her heart. How about Janis Joplin asking for a Mercedes-Benz?
A Mercedes-Benz.
Sold.
My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends.
And here's your takeaway for this hour.
It's a bad feeling when people feel like it's over before it's even begun.
That's David Zirin talking about the Chicago Cubs. Is their season over? Not yet. They can make the playoffs. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's how you reach us. I'm John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.